Okay, so we have now a sense of the colonial history involved in issues of land alienation and self-determination. How does the terror raids that happened fit into that picture at this point? What about these charges of paramilitary training camps? What actually was going on that the government reacted to so vindictively?
Well, I think in the first instance, so after 26 days, the Solicitor General said there is no case to answer on these terrorism charges. He said there is insufficient evidence. And so we were released, but we continue to face charges under the Arms Act. And overwhelmingly, as I said, those people were from Thu Hoi, and Thu Hoi continued to try to seek some restitution of their land, in particular the Uruwera National Park, which has been turned into an area for all New Zealanders, but for them is their homeland, mm-hmm. and an area that was guaranteed to them by the Uruwera Lands Act of 1898. And so they continue to seek that justice and have continued to seek that justice for more than 100 years. And so one of the primary defendants, I suppose, the primary people involved in this case is a person called Tame Iti, who is a long-term Māori sovereignty activist and a person who has been a vocal critic of New Zealand government and its racist policies. And so many of the Māori sovereignty activists in this country have been the subject of enormous amounts of police harassment and brutality, surveillance by the SIS, the Security Intelligence Service, over long periods of time. And Tame is probably number one or two on the list of those people. So that has been an ongoing issue. But he is a charismatic figure, a figure who has been involved in the workers' rights movement, in the anti-apartheid movement, mm-hmm. and is a social justice activist around a lot of causes. And so bringing, you know, people together, anti-war activists, union activists, animal rights activists, is not uncommon for Tame. He is a people person very mm-hmm. much, and an artist, and is someone who, yeah, is sort of in love with the world, and so in love with fighting for freedom and for justice. And so the idea that there were anarchists talking to people interested in Māori sovereignty was, I think, a really frightening thing for the government. Mm-hmm. And I guess what I would say about the charges themselves is that, you know, in my mind, there's nothing fundamentally wrong with running around the bush with guns. In fact, people in this country do it all the time. Mm-hmm. But if you run around the bush with guns in this country and have left-wing ideas, that's where the problems come mm-hmm. in. And I think that's in essence, where things are at. You know, that mm-hmm. as far as the case goes, there are lots of people who will make a variety of legal arguments. But following on from the arms charges, about a year after the initial raids, five of those people, including Tame, were charged with membership in a organized criminal group, which is a charge that's used fundamentally against organized gangs like mm-hmm. Black Power mm-hmm. and the Mongrel Mob, you know, big motorcycle clubs. And the idea that they are gang members is really quite obscene, actually. Yeah, yeah. But it's not an uncommon charge, as I understand, in Europe. In Germany in particular, Section 129... and 129A, one is their terrorism charge, one is their criminal gang charge. And the Red Army faction, for example, was charged under their criminal gang charge rather than their terrorism charge. And this has been a sort of a recurrent theme. In my mind, the criminal group charge is very, very much a face-saving exercise for the Crown at this point. They were unable to bring those terrorism charges. They invaded the community of Ruatoki, mm-hmm. this tiny little Māori yeah. village. They locked it down. They held people, literally women and children, at gunpoint. And they needed to be able to say this was justified. And mm-hmm. so they brought this further charge against these five people. Mm-hmm. I think it would be extraordinarily unlikely that charge would have carry any weight at all. It just seems to me just absolutely ludicrous when looking at the elements of the charge. But I think that they gain quite a lot of mileage out of being able to say, well, listen, it's not just arms charges, it's organized criminal group. And the media always sort of likes to drop these other things, and they're, oh, they're people, drugs, and, you know, there are no drugs. There's, yeah, yeah. You know, there's nothing else involved. You know, this is, they like to be able to cloud the issue and say, well, really, these people are just criminals. And we always try to bring the matter back into the political realm, but indeed that is a difficult challenge. You know, the court certainly doesn't have any room for recognizing the political nature of the case, and I think it will be a real challenge for us in terms of defending the charges to talk about the wider issues of colonization, about the issues of confiscation, about the issues of previous invasions, which I think are of extraordinary relevance. Those communities live that reality on a day-to-day basis. This isn't something that happened 170 years ago. This is something that happened yesterday, you know. And the matter of the creation of the Udawada National Park, that's something that happened in the 50s. You know, these people were, many of them, alive and well when their homeland was turned into a national park and put under the control of a government department. So,
So at this point then, it seems to me pretty clear from what you're saying that there's this attempt to criminalize political dissent and resistance. You are involved in this court case in a very Kafkaesque kind of proceeding in trying to defend yourselves. You yourself are one of the defendants. Where are you at in all this at this point? What stage is it at? I understand that you have been denied a jury trial, and tell us more about that.
So the proceedings through the court system have been long and gruesome. So more than 3 years of, you know, an occasional pre-trial application. And late last year, the High Court in Auckland ruled that we would be tried by a judge alone, which seems actually quite surreal. But given the context of New Zealand politics at the moment, not really that unusual. And I'll just say a little bit about what happened last year, which was a trial of three political activists, Catholic plowshare workers, who went into the Waihopai spy base and popped the covering over one of the spy dishes, the satellite dishes. The Waihopai spy base is part of the International Echelon Listening Network, which is based in Pine Gap in Australia and Menwith Hill in England and all over the United States and Canada, as part of the UK-USA agreement, of which Canada, the United States, Australia, New Zealand, and England are the founding members. So these guys broke in and popped the dome and sat down and set up a shrine and said, yep, we did it, but we did it because we wanted to save the lives of people in Iraq and Afghanistan who were being bombed to death by the Americans. They had a jury trial in the Wellington District Court, and they were acquitted. And it is certainly my view that the Crown in this particular case is absolutely desperate to ensure that they get convictions, and they have decided that one of the best ways they can do that is to deny us a jury trial. And the law was changed in 2007 in New Zealand to say that the Crown could apply for trial by judge alone for serious and complex cases. And so we've been in the Court of Appeal this week trying to get that overturned, but actually there's very little hope that that will happen.
And is it the same Terrorism and Suppression Act that allows them to forego a jury trial, or is that a separate piece of legislation?
No, it's a rather innocuous sounding bill called the Criminal Procedures Act, which you know doesn't get sort of nice liberals up in arms. And I suppose the problem with much that happens in the criminal justice system is that unless you are involved in the criminal justice system or have experience with that, you really don't have much idea about what these things mean, you know? Mm-hmm. Sort of people think, oh, maybe trial by judge alone. Oh, I could see how maybe that might be useful in some instances. And the whole trial by judge alone was sold on the notion that this was for serious and complex fraud cases where you had multiple layers of transactions, right. Shell companies, you know, things that right. a jury might have a great deal of difficulty getting a hold of.
Right.
It wasn't intended to be for matters which were relatively straightforward. Yes, there are, in our case, quite a few defendants. But the issues are fairly straightforward. It's did they have guns? And if they did have guns, did they have a lawful purpose for having right. the guns? So that's and just to touch on the issue of the arms charges, in New Zealand, and expanding on the notion of it being Kafkaesque, is that unlike most charges in New Zealand and Canada, you are, in essence, under the Arms Act, guilty until proven innocent. So if you are found to be in possession... and possession has a very broad term. It doesn't literally mean you had a gun in your hand. It might even mean that just you were in the vicinity of someplace
yeah.
that had a gun. Mm-hmm. You are in possession and you are guilty unless you can prove you had a lawful mm-hmm. purpose.
Yeah.
And so we are now in the position of having to, in essence, defend our innocence, which mm-hmm. is a much, much greater threshold than in essence, being not guilty. So mm-hmm. that is where we are at. We've got a trial set yeah. down for the 31st of May in the High Court in Auckland for 12 weeks,
yeah.
Which may stretch out actually to being actually 4 months in terms mm-hmm. of sitting time. And, defendants having to right. travel from around the country, having to find accommodation and transport and food and all of that kind of stuff for many, many months in a place that's about to host the Rugby World Cup.
Mm-hmm.
And so literally accommodation will be going for thousands of dollars a night. So
crazy.
The whole thing just, and just returning to your point about political activism, I think criminalizing political activists, whether or not those charges ultimately are contrived, is one of the surest ways of destroying political movements. And we have had a host of incursions by the state into our political movements, yeah. and that includes infiltration by both the state and private forces, private investigators putting in infiltrators and agent provocateurs, the police mm-hmm. having someone mm-hmm. in our movement for 10 years who was being paid as an informant, and an enormous amount of spurious charges being brought against people, mm-hmm. which ultimately were dropped.
Yeah.
But the process of going through that, even if the charges are very minor, disorderly behavior mm-hmm. or trespass or whatever, for many people, they find that so disempowering, so distressing and stressful that mm-hmm. they simply aren't willing to put themselves in a position of going through that again.
Right. Well, it's a form of intimidation and discreditation of... you know, what it is that the political essence is all about. Recently, several years ago in British Columbia, there was a similar kind of situation that happened where a group called the Native Youth Movement, a very militant group, had been doing survival training and traditional skills training with youth. And there was the use of some weapons that were being used, as part of this. And the government there decided to bust a number of people as they were on the Burrard Bridge, which is a bridge out of Vancouver, just swooped down, busted them, tried to discredit them as terrorists, and tried to intimidate anybody who would be associated with the Native Youth Movement. It's a similar kind of strategy. It's the ongoing kind of colonial heritage that, you know, we're seeing popping up over and over again. I know you've written a book about all this, or put together an anthology in which you've given voice to people about the experience of the terror raids. And a number of those voices are very poignant in one way or another, either in talking about their own experience that day of the raids or broader political issues. You want to tell us more about that book?
The book is called The Day the Raids Came, and for the folks in Canada, you can read it for free download on the rebelpress.org.nz website. The book for me was, a little bit of a catharsis, because for a lot of those people, obviously I was in jail when these stories were happening, when they were unfolding. So a lot of those stories I hadn't heard before, hadn't heard in any detail. And to be fair, the stories, and there's about 15 stories in that book, are really only scratching the surface of the experiences on that day. And people throughout New Zealand have stories about things that happened, really, that I don't even know about now. But it was a way for me to explore some of those issues, to talk about some of the things that had happened, and to give voice to some of those people in a way that the mainstream media certainly never would. And we have been, the mainstream media has gone a long way to discrediting all of us and painting a picture of us as terrorists, and including publishing extracts of suppressed information, intercepted conversations, which were no longer able to be used because the terrorism charges weren't brought. So they had recorded all of these fiery conversations of people saying the likes of, you know, I want to shoot George Bush in the head. And I think, well, gee, that's a sensible person. The special investigations group of the police think, gee, that's a terrorist. And what I would say is that, you know, in after all of these proceedings were finished and these terrorism charges weren't brought, the local newspaper got a hold of all of the suppressed information from a security leak, and in essence published it on the front page of the paper in order to validate the police. And so what they've got are quotes taken completely out of context, sensationalized, and published as little nuggets to sort of tantalize people and to restore their faith in the police.
Right.
Now, I'd say to most sensible people, if you go around and are recorded 24 hours a day, you can be sure that there are some things that you say which don't show you in the very best of light. Now, that may not necessarily be fiery political talk if that's not the kind of person that you are. But for many of us who are involved in radical politics, you know, talking like that is the most common thing in the world. You know, talking about social revolution, talking about, you know, hated dictators and war criminals is utterly ordinary. And I would say that there's a huge difference between talk and action. You know, there is a huge gap between what people want to see in the world and where we are in terms of getting that, you know, and changing the social landscape. So, you know, for me, social revolution is about the people of this land and the people around the world and changing perspectives. You know, it's not about a little group of militants going off and committing political assassinations. It's nonsense. You know, I'm not interested in a coup d'etat or a change of head of state. I am interested in a social revolution that involves changes at the root of how we organize our way of being in the world, and that is a totally different matter, and requires totally different steps. So I think that's the real lack of understanding in the likes of mainstream institutions, particularly within the police. And the police in New Zealand have a long history of surveilling and harassing political activists, as does the Security Intelligence Service, long history of harassing activists. So we shouldn't be surprised that after 9/11 and the war on terror, that they turn their sights back on to what the state considers its greatest threat, which is effectively its illegitimacy as a government of a colonial nation that went around stealing the indigenous land, you know, and that is the fundamental point that we return to, which is that the New Zealand government, like the government in the United States and the government in Canada and the government in Australia, has got to come to terms with the fact that their sovereignty, in effect, rests on a lie.
Yeah.
And must make some reckoning with that and find some way to go forward that puts Indigenous people back into the positions of power that they rightfully occupy.
Well,
I'm just thinking, well, one way that they're trying to do that in here, as I've heard, and in BC, is to work out some kind of deal where the indigenous people get a percentage of the resource extraction profits, you know, on their land as part of the deal of finalizing a land settlement with them. So that plays into it. I don't know what you'd like to say about that.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there are a whole lot of models that, in essence, are being tried here. And the treaty settlement process here has resulted in the corporatization of a lot of tribal authorities. And, you know, some of my Māori friends call them the business brown table or the tribal capitalists. And I think the real difference there is that those organizations must function within a capitalist system. They don't have any choice. I think it is important that we don't, in essence, blame those people for attempting to get the most out of that system that they possibly can when they have been so completely destroyed by colonial expansion and capitalism. But I guess I would say there is a fundamental difference between operating within a white supremacist capitalist paradigm and an indigenous worldview, which might completely upturn the notions of capitalism. So I think that is a real point that we are at now. And within Māoridom, I think there are some real tensions going on because for the vast majority of Māori, they're working class or underclass people. They are not enjoying the fruits of those few settlements that have happened. There is increasingly a stratification of Māori society, with some Māori at the very top, but overwhelmingly, Māori have not enjoyed any of those resource sharing or return of lands or resources that have happened. They have been a pittance. And so that model does not appear to provide any real just and enduring solution. But again, I return to the point that I don't think that that's the fault necessarily of those tribal leaders or people in positions of power within Māori society, but rather the larger context within which they operate. Mm-hmm. And I think that fundamentally it's going to require the relinquishment of power by Pākehā, by white institutions, in order to achieve some actual justice. Yeah, I mean, Māori society is not a society of centralized control. Prior to the arrival of the colonizer, Māori society was very much individual sort of tribes and sub-tribes of hapū, like extended families, with individual leaders within those groups and kind of consensus-based decision-making within those groups, and effectively total sovereignty of those individual groups, and in some cases kinds of quasi-federations, which were more genealogical, I guess, in nature, what in New Zealand is called whakapapa ties to a common ancestor, for example, that bound groups of people together, and ties through conquest or ties through, you know, shared occupation of lands and things like that. And certainly important not to romanticize that way of organizing society. There was much about it that is, you know, was I think very harsh and difficult and brutal, but at the same time it is in total contrast to the centralized nation state that we have now. And so I think for Māori it is trying to negotiate a crown dictated way of justice is never ever going to deliver for the vast majority of the people. So I think that's where things sit at the moment. And Māori have had a variety of strategies over the last 170 years of trying to survive. And I think that is what they have tried to do. They have tried, in some cases, some of their leaders have, you know, advocated assimilation into mainstream society. Some of them have advocated separatist, you know, avenues, and there certainly in the 1970s there was a real cultural sort of renaissance of sorts within the Māori world, which has, I think, created a very strong pan-Māori identity. But in the process, I think it cloaks a lot of the class differences which fundamentally exist in Māori society and allow some of the policies which are sold to Māori to be perpetuated, because there is not an analysis of class that also goes hand in hand with that Māori identity. So that is some of the stuff that is being played out in New Zealand politics right now, which is very, very interesting. So just to get a sense of where Māori sit in New Zealand society, overwhelmingly Māori are represented in the lower socioeconomic classes. 50% of the male prison population is Māori, 70% of the female prison population is Māori, and that is when Māori in society are around 19% of the total population. So overwhelmingly, they are represented disproportionately in the prison and criminal justice system. But in almost every other socioeconomic indicator, they are at the very bottom.
Okay, well, this will be the final closing question. I mean, thanks so much for illuminating all these issues. What I'm wondering at this point is, based on what you've been saying, one of the things that has been revealed by this recent terror raids case is the basis for alliance between Maori activists and anarchists. And I'm wondering how you see that. What are the possibilities for affinity there that that exist and that might take us into some future kinds of ways in which anarchists and Maori sovereignty activists can work together?
I say that I think anarchists and indigenous activists share the perspective that the self-determination of all people and the autonomy of all people is a goal that we should all strive for, and I think that that is some good common ground on which to work together. I don't think that we necessarily agree on all things, but as I was alluding to before, I think that we all could learn a great deal from Indigenous perspectives, worldviews. And I think that as our environmental biosphere gets closer and closer to the point of collapse, we need to really fundamentally examine ideas around progress, around technology, and examine our relationship to the rest of the things that live on this planet and in the universe. And I think that, yeah, again, not without wanting to romanticize those views, I think that we have a great deal to learn from Indigenous people around the world, not just Māori, but Aboriginal people who are the oldest civilization on Earth. And they've been around for a very, very long time with some degree of harmony with their natural environment. And I think the fundamental re-examination of our relationship with the natural world is absolutely crucial at this point. And I think that Māori could teach us a great deal about not just the natural world, but about how to organize our society, how to make decisions. And and I suppose that's where I think that affinity exists. And I'd like to see some of those relationships grow and be enhanced over the coming years. And I think that there are many, many anarchists in this country that, and many people, not just anarchists, yeah, but see the fundamental injustice of colonization, and feel that that is an imperative, an urgency that must be dealt with. And I think that that is at the forefront of that struggle.
Okay, well, we've been talking to Valerie Morse here in Wellington, and thanks for being part of Tree Frog Radio. Sheila, do you have a final word to say?
Thanks for hosting us, and I guess maybe we could, I guess that's all.
All right.
I do it separate.
That was cool, really.
I can cut that last part out.
Yeah,
easy. Yeah. But I do want to, because I wanted to ask for a